Because you're jumping back into the gap. I'll let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind BasketballImmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. Excited today to have Doug Novak of Bethel University on podcast. And coach, welcome to the podcast. And I can say this about a lot of coaches, obviously, because I've had wonderful conversations, but I'm really excited for this one. I've followed your stuff for a long time, and I've had the great opportunity to be able to watch your point of attack finishing DVD as well, and it's tremendous stuff, and I look forward to diving deeper into this.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. And coach, I mean, great success at Bethel. You're the winningest coach there, I believe, in the last 5 years. You've had the best record in the history of Bethel. And then previous to that, a Division I assistant coach at Tulane in the Citadel. And something that we'll loop back to a little bit later, which I want to make sure we get into, is that your background's in tennis a little bit as well. So we'll dive back into that. But let's start with this, coach. And in my mind, something that has separated your point of attack finishing DVD from so many others that I've watched through my years, and it's just how well it's outlined. And I can see the teaching in your background and how you laid out the DVD, in the sense that when I watch clinics or I watch DVDs, sometimes I see coaches go far too long on a drill, for example, where all we need is a quick 30-second clip of it or a quick 30-second hit of it, and then we understand it, we can move on, rather than having a team in a clinic situation go 10 minutes to complete the drill. We don't need to see that. And your DVD covers so much so well, because I think you get right to the point. I'm assuming that was a focal point of what you were trying to outline.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to be able to create something that I'd want to buy or something that would be useful. So I didn't really talk a lot about stories or anything, but we just got right to the point, and hence the title of Point of Attack, and starting with the end in mind. So kind of cut through all of the fluff, all the stuff that creates advantages, and let's just get right to the bare bones of how are we going to finish in front of the rim? How are we going to finish to the side? What are your counters coming from the left, coming from the right, and have some go-to moves? And then right away, establish game footage behind it. I always like to see that. If I ever watch a DVD, I always want to go to Synergy and watch that team actually play. It's what am I seeing? Does it add up?
Well, and that's the other part of it that I was going to say, is the game footage that connects each thing that you teach with something that actually happens in the game helps me understand that this isn't just a product. This is what you actually do. And that's genuine sharing. And as we know, we've been to so many clinics where we've seen certain celebrity coaches do their clinic and they teach something that they absolutely don't do. Or they provide us with drills that, you know what, nowadays you certainly don't need to buy a DVD to learn the three-man weave. But they go through that for about 10 minutes. And just, again, that's not what we're signing up for. We're not signing up for the stories. You and I were signing up for the coaching.
Right. And actually, the project was a selfish pursuit that I try to do at the end of every year, is to make sure that our teaching is adding up to what's actually happening. So I wanted to be able to validate some of the drills or advantage drills that we're doing, and are they showing up in the game? And so as you go through it last year or the years before, and we kind of as a compilation of many years, it's like, is that stuff actually showing up, or are we wasting time? So if I can back it up with video in my own mind, then I know that we're on the right track in terms of how we're conducting our practices.
Well, and that's a metaphor for everything, really. I mean, again, for you
and I, and I know people that follow us that know that there's almost an obsession to be able to do exactly what you do. We're not filling any part of our practice with fluff. We want to fill it with what we do. So, and that's great. And go ahead.
And that's the goal, because I know what I taught, but I want to see what's actually happening. And sometimes after a season, when the emotions have subsided a little bit, you can see things a little bit clearly. So I just want to, are these things matching up? And that's really important to me. And I think it helps to run a little more effective program and practice.
And coaches, this isn't a promotional podcast for the DVD, but
Like, I really do want you to go check out, if you haven't yet, CoachDougNovak.com, regardless of the DVD, but I think the DVD is tremendous and I encourage you to purchase it. But just go there and check out Coach's information. I mean, again, as I said, he's been a model of sharing for a long time and he puts so much of his program's philosophy out there. And Coach, I got to believe that the other part of everything that you do on this website is designed for recruiting. Because when you go recruit a player, you can direct them to exactly who you are and they know who they're going to be coached by and what type of program they're going to be in. Is that true?
That is true. And that's how it originally started. But as with many things, you're not always aware of the byproducts that offspring from those types of endeavors. And so it started out as Bethel University is a faith school, but it's not one of those weird strangling Christian type stuff that I don't really like. It's a leadership school. And so I wanted to be able to explain how I saw Bethel University and the Christian beliefs and philosophy and how I thought it all incorporated into one, in my words. And so, and then I didn't want to have anybody else trying to establish, you know, what Bethel is. I wanted to be able to do that out front. And then on the back end of it, I thought, while we're making this website, I'm going to put some style of play. And then my technology skills are so bad. I have friends from all around the country because I've just been able to coach at some different places. And we always share ideas. I thought, rather than trying to send my friends different things, I'm just going to put it out there. And so I just put some of our practice drills out there. And then that started to grow. And then it really started to grow. And then you always have a little bit of trepidation. Well, what should I show? What is this secret to our program? And then after a while, you just get to be a certain age. And you just, I just said, who cares? And if we all play a little bit better basketball, it's good for all of us. And I know what it takes, you know, in terms of paying attention and the order of teaching. We're not giving away anything that's not out there. But if there's a little more efficient way that somebody could do something, that's awesome. But the best part of it is just the relationships that are built off of that website, is you get to talk to other coaches and challenge your ideas. And nobody's probably stressed me out more than you have, Coach. Because as I've looked at your stuff and how much you give away, and there's just, it's amazing the amount of information that comes about. But it does stretch me in terms of what I think and how I think the game should be played. And I do have convictions of how we want to play, but I don't want to be a prisoner to some prototype that I developed and only playing one way. And you just keep on stretching me in ways like, I'm not sure about this, but I'm going to look. I'm going to take a deep look at this and maybe this is something we want to do.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. And thank you so much for that, because I don't know if you could compliment me any better than that. Because that's the goal of everything that I do. I've said this to numerous coaches, and I don't want to create any disciples. That's not the goal. I don't want to create a tribe of people that do exactly what I do. I'm just sharing it. So one, like you said, I can connect with people. And two, I can hopefully help the game in some way. And feedback has been tremendous. And, you know, as I said, there's so many coaches, but you're certainly one of the originals that has done such a tremendous job with this. And I appreciate that. And Coach, maybe let's lead with that then. Do you go through any evaluation process about saying, hey, something stimulates you? And it's like that old Don Meyer about get all good ideas you can, but you can't use them all. Do you have an actual kind of process you can articulate that you go through in evaluating whether this is something I want to do or this is not going to change what we do?
Well, it is kind of a long process. And I like the different phases of a season. You know, kind of starts in the summer with us, with our camp, and all of our guys work the camp, or most of them. And our goal is to teach them how to be teachers more than anything else. So they don't get to hold the ball. They don't get to dribble while kids are doing different drills and skills type stuff. I mean, they are teaching and it's not easy. And so, which helps us in the long run, because they're able to teach on the floor to our guys to talk, learn how to talk to each other. But there's a phase of a summer where you're in a camp setting and you're with little kids and you're fighting like heck to help them with some coordination and some decision making and how to put your hand on top of a ball and how to be efficient with your starts and your stops. And we're all kind of in this thing together. And then while we're doing that, we're going out to watch AAU. And so whatever philosophy we have in terms of how we want to hold the ball, how we want to stop and protect, like, I'm either getting validation for what we do, or I'm just watching kids play and say, boy, that is interesting. Maybe that's something we can incorporate. And while we're in camp and with campers, like, we experiment a ton. We try out all kinds of things and say, I don't like this and I like this. And it's really a great place for innovation. And it really doesn't matter the level of the player. In fact, the worse player they are, the better teachers we become, because we have to be more efficient with our language and we have to be more efficient with how we want to set something up, or maybe even with court space. You got 10 kids at a basket and they're running into each other. So we're just going to use that middle channel and create a decision-making drill or a skill drill just in this small area. Well, I probably should have done that in the first place, but because we didn't have space, it caused some innovation. So that phase of camp, and then we start to like prune down a little bit and say, this is who we're going to be. And this is what we want to do. And usually I have all kinds of crazy ideas over the summer. And then when it comes October 15th and we have the guys right there, it comes down to the same really basic things, creating a strong foundation and a base so that they're able to make the correct decisions. Because without that base, I just don't think we can make that decision. After the season, little bit of space, and then we are breaking down our team more than we're watching anybody else. We will glance at other people, we'll glance at the NBA, we'll glance at your stuff on your website, which is awesome. But really, it's about what just happened with a clear set of eyes. And again, trying to say, is what we taught, is that what happened? Are there players teaching us some things that we might want to put them into more of those types of situations? And then just see how a player grew from one year to the next. And we want to have enough space for them to grow, as opposed to just being in a system of, we're just trying to be Noah's Ark and we're trying to have two of everything. We want to have the flexibility to let guys grow within their game.
Well, that's great. Thanks for sharing that process, because I think
that's important for coaches to have a process of evaluating all these amazing ideas. And I think we're certainly, there's more of them now in the internet era than there were 20 years ago. But coach, I'm glad you said the thing about camp too, because I think so many coaches miss the boat on camps. And well, I think we've given camps a bad name because a lot of camps have become kind of keep them happy camps rather than teaching camps. And clearly through my 20 years, I don't think anything has made me a better teacher than summer camps because of those things that you said. And it's just amazing because when you're teaching it to your players, sometimes there's assumptions. And when you teach it to other players that don't know your things or don't know your terms, then there's no assumptions. And the other reason that coaches need to go to your website is your language. Your language is outstanding. And I've stolen a ton of it. So, coach, hopefully we'll take some time here to go through your language. But can we start with decisive, fast, and free? Because I love that phrasing. What does that mean? And how do you use your team represent that?
Well, I don't want our players to be burdened by an offense. And I really think you can put weights on their back. And so, for example, every time we catch the ball, it is me first. It's my shot. I mean, I don't care if you're a non-shooter. It doesn't matter to me. I want a certain type of footwork that, you know, there's not enough time in the day to teach all the footwork. So, you know, we pick one that we think is the most efficient. And you're looking to shoot that ball every time. There's an order that can kind of free you up. If I'm thinking, hey, that might be a pass there, that might be an attack here, it's always your shot first, and which puts my eyes on the rim. And then it allows me to chunk the necessary information quickly so that I can make the right decision, which might be stopping my shot and rolling my hips and quickly getting rid of the ball to throw a one down to the guy that's wide open in the corner. If I don't work my feet and if I don't keep my eyes on that rim and if I don't stop my shot, even if it's just eyes on the rim, then my defender is able to play two. And I don't want him playing two. He's got to be able to guard me. I want a north-south in an east-west component to the game. And so, you know, me first, but then it's the next part of it is for us. And that's where the joy comes from, because it's not me first, me second. My job is to work those things so that I can go get a layup. And if I can't, then I'm giving it to someone else and I'm making him better. But it's weird terminology a little bit for guys when you hear that. We actually give them some t-shirts that says me first on it, which isn't what most team guys do. But I just think their whole lives they've been hearing a team first, team, 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 team. And we're not saying anti-team, but we're just kind of flipping it on them that this is how you become a team. It's not by just making a pass to make a pass. And sometimes I mock our players because I use sarcasm a little bit to teach. I say, that's a great pass, Johnny. Now it's second and seven. I said, this isn't football. I said, we're doing things for a purpose, and I can make him better by executing some of these fundamental skills. So the order, I think the game just goes so fast. We're not teaching synchronized swimming. And if it was, we could just do a bunch of 1-on-0, 5-on-0, and make those guys look good. But there's just distractions all over the place. So if I can give them something to help the game slow down so that they have more time and space to make the decision, then I want to be able to give them those things to help them become a better basketball player. So decisive, fast, and free, that's how we want to play. We don't want to play with a burden. We want to, that is your shot every single time. And then the backside of that one would be, if he takes it and misses it, then I can't be all over him for taking that shot. You know, was it open? Were you ready to shoot it? Was it hands down? That's it. Good shot. Now, was that next guy more open? Well, you might want to go one down on that one. You know, that's the best shooter in our gym, and you didn't move the ball. You probably want to do that.
Coach, is one down your term for like good to great, that next pass? Is that what you mean?
Yes. Yeah. Either like one down, one ups.
Yeah.
Yep. There's a baseline drift.
Yeah. Look, I like the analogy. And so based on what you're saying, you're okay scoring on first down. That's what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah. And or creating an advantage on first down.
And that has been an evolution over the years. So I don't know how many years I've been doing this, like 27, 28. When you start, sometimes the organization of a practice gets in the way of actual teaching, but you don't know what you don't know. So you're sometimes you're trying to survive. And the offense becomes more important than the ultimate goal, which is putting the ball in the basket. And I remember one year I was creating some things offensively and I didn't want to turn the ball over. And we did such a nice job with our pivots and protecting. And we were unbelievable. And then when I was just sitting back looking at it, I said to myself, well, how are we going to score? And the ultimate goal is to put the ball in the basket. So if I have a guy that's really good off the bounce coming down in a fast break, he doesn't need a ball screen. All he needs is space. But the guy next to him is a better cutter. Can we use both of those guys and not be married to a system? Systems drive me crazy just because sometimes you hear coaches, well, when he learns the system, then he's going to be a good player. And I'm saying bad system. I said the players override everything in my mind. It's our job to make sure that we got the best guys on the floor. And so a system can't keep them out.
No, I like that. And me first for us. Something that I heard really for the first time this summer, although I'm sure I read it before with some of your stuff, but that theme has actually come through quite frequently. And it's caused me to change, or I shouldn't say change because it's always been the philosophy, but to be even more direct with my players, to openly tell them that they're selfish if they don't shoot an open shot. They're selfish if they don't catch it ready to attack. Yeah. And your language and through Nate Oates, because that's you kind of phrased that too for me. That's brought me confidence to say that more directly to my players. And it's been excellent for them to get that understanding of it's really hard to get good shots. So if we've got a good one, that's great for our whole team. So I love that. And I hope coaches take some part of that away. Coach, the other thing you said is create space in order to utilize our skills. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because spacing is obviously such a huge part of the game, but I don't think all coaches connect that to the fact that allows all the skill work you do to be used, to be successful.
Well, I think nothing is more frustrating, and I was guilty of this early on in my coaching career, but to work on a skill, to work on becoming a better basketball player, and then not have space or an opportunity to use those skills. And you could say that about any profession. You're working really hard. That's what burnout usually doesn't happen because you're working too hard. Burnout happens when you don't have an opportunity to grow. You don't have an opportunity to use the skills in which allows for growth on a daily basis. So, for instance, when we first started out, the offense was more important than the actual player when I first started out coaching. And we might have a beautiful staggered screen going on. And then the defender was playing the wing on the low side, and we drove middle into the staggered screen. And I would get mad at the kid for doing that, even though that we had spent 15 minutes working on that particular move before practice. And like, why are you doing that? You're screwing up the offense because there's no room. And so even then, when I was young and I was saying, I knew I wasn't quite right, but I didn't know the answer. I couldn't quite figure that out yet because I was still conflicted with offense and skills. And so we tried to evolve into a style of play where at any point in time, you do something silly on me and I have the ball, like I'm going to take you and I'm going to go try and score it. That overrides anything we're doing on offense. And part of that spacing and time, creating that space, it goes pretty deep. We have like four things, how we want to get to a particular place, but each one has depth. So what helps with space is that my teammate throws me a strike. I don't have to move. It goes right to my hands. That gives me more time. And time is crucial for me to be able to make the right decision. I know they train policemen. I can't remember the term. It might be white space, but you know, like someone's hiding around the corner and you just turn and someone jumps you. And that is hard to make the right decision, you know, in that white space type area. So we're trying to create as much space as we can so that we can have the maximum vision so that we can see what the best play is. And so a lot of it is placement on the court, but it's also how efficiently and the timing of when I'm receiving the basketball, how I'm catching the basketball, and then how efficient I'm going to be getting the ball down on the floor if I decide not to shoot it to attack. You have a really neat concept, and I didn't really understand it at first. I think you call it the stab dribble.
Yes.
Is that where you're trying to just get the ball down quick?
So immediately,
or maybe.
It's immediately get the ball down so you get into the decision-making part. Because really the decision is the difficult part. But the other part of the stab dribble is that it creates a deception with the defender because immediately, again, if coaches want to visualize it, you don't get the ball necessarily straight down, but you cross get it down or you in and out get it down and you get your shoulders involved. So some of our players who aren't as quick, they immediately get into a little bit of a body movement that allows them to create an advantage to be able to push out and attack. And all of it relates back to biomechanics as well, which is this understanding that if you take too long of a first step, then you're overextended essentially, so you can't fire as fast on your second step. So a lot of it relates.
And it's that second step that really matters. Again, growing up playing basketball and growing up going to some camps and listening to coaches, and you see this long extended one. And, you know, that was the communicated knowledge that I received. And so you kind of do it. But then you're also thinking, like, I never do that. And maybe I should try it. And then you have revealed knowledge is like, you know what, that didn't work very well. I'm going to stick with mine, or we're going to do this because this is what really happens.
I love that because, Coach, you said that already. You said you learned from your players. And I'm telling you, I completely changed from teaching any type of like step forward, first step. And my players still do that. I don't want people to think they don't do that. But when we do that, we try and do it off of more of what we'd call a quicking concept, which is they're catching it already moving forward into the ball. But in watching my players and asking them, I said, do you actually do this? And I found that they never did it when I evaluated that over a summer. And that's what brought me back to the stab dribble. And of course, European influences, they certainly were ahead of the game with that. They just focused on getting the ball down. And for honestly, the youth level, the biggest advantage is it eliminates any type of travel. It's just the ball's down. The ball's down. Now you're into the attack and counter decision-making stuff.
No, and the faster we can get that ball down, whether it's with the stab dribble or our terminology would be if we're going right, we got just a little circle, but we're pounding that ball down fast and getting it to the floor fast, the faster I can get it to my hand. And again, just from coaching so long, there's a lot of ball handling drills out there and we do very little. And I want our primary handler to be, he's just normally a better ball handler, but the rest of them, if they can be really sound with two dribbles and then maybe they have to go to a counter and put a guy in their back with a Barkley as a protection, that's fine. But the two dribbles is not as easy as you think. You know, to be able to keep your hand on the ball and keep your eyes on the rim. And again, if we're coaching synchronized swimming, we can do that really simple with no pressure. But again, this is a game of distraction and there's a score. You know, there's parents in the stands. There's a girlfriend in the stands. And as soon as somebody touches you, it's everybody's instinct for their eyes to go down. So we are constantly putting pressure on those guys to keep their eyes on the rim no matter what. And that's probably a life lesson too, is that that's what we do. We set a goal and we receive pressure and our eyes divert from the goal. And for us, that's a huge part of being able to make the decision is know where you're looking. We have wide motion, but we really have narrow vision. And then we try to chunk information from that. In some ways, the same way a quarterback might when he reads the defensive backs or a safety, is that he doesn't need to look at everything. He can look at it a little bit and then get all the information he needs to make the right decision.
Well, and Coach, you brought that up, so let's talk about that. Coaches ask all the time, and how do I increase the percentage of made layups for my players? How do I reduce the number of misses for my players? And the easiest answer is shoot better shots, right? Like, don't shoot shots you can't make. That's the easy answer. But the reality is, even sometimes on open layups or whatnot, players miss
layups. You know, sometimes we will say, is like, you act like you're having a bad day. You're not having a bad day. You will never hit that shot. It will always be a low percentage shot. You're not having a bad day.
I like that. Are there any specific teaching points? We don't want to obviously go through the whole video because I know you've got some exceptional teaching points and a great way of breaking it down. But just on at the point of the shot, is there anything that you emphasize for your players that can help coaches kind of frame what their players should be doing when they're shooting a layup or some close to the basket shot?
Yeah. Well, one thing before we get started on that was interesting. I was listening to another podcast of yours, and you, I think you had made mention to if you had a group of young kids that you were teaching, you would spend most of your practice like shooting layups. And then you would develop a jump shot a little bit later, which made me feel a little bit better because we spend so much time on how to finish around that rim, even with our college guys.
Right. Well, I guess my point is overemphasis on prepubescent kids learning how to shoot versus learning how to dribble and drive and score at the rim. If we spent more time on that, then we'd have more players better at finishing at the rim because shooting is really a late development skill.
Right. I agree with that. So it's kind of our contention that the best players are just a little bit more coordinated than the next guy. So we want to be able to create efficient habits that hold up under pressure. And when you have bad habits, you really don't have any freedom. You know, it's like being on drugs. I'm a slave to that drug. I'm a slave to swinging the basketball to gain momentum. So, you know, what we try to do is teach a little bit of coordination. And there's a off of that DVD series. If you land on the right foot, if you can pop it in a certain way, I can do everything. I can go off 1 foot. I can go off 2 foot. I can sidestep you. I can redirect it. So just giving that little bit of a hint or a little bit of a help allows them to have some more freedom when it comes time to make that decision. And so a popping of the ball by my ear away from the defense allows me to do many things. Now, one thing that we found in looking at all this, and some coaches don't like it at all, but I'm a smaller guy and I used to do it all the time. And even if I wasn't coached, I just did it because it worked. But just like one hand reaches and I don't put the other hand on the ball. And maybe the reason why that was successful for me, because I swung the ball as a kid trying to shoot layups. So you could get by the first line of defense. But, you know, as the level goes up, the hands get faster and they get a hand on your ball as you're trying to go shoot a layup.
Coach, can I just clarify that for people? Because what we're saying by swing the ball is the ball moves from hip to hip. And the other part that goes with that is that it takes longer to get to the rim, gets longer to get to the release point, which is the other part.
Correct.
You move up in levels is that when you swing it, it takes longer to get it to the release.
That's a good point. So the one interesting detail with the one hand reach is the balancing of the ball in the hand, which looks harder than what it is just because of the momentum of the ball and you going to the rim. It just sticks to your hand regardless of hand size. But it makes a guy keep the ball still. So obviously you can't swing it. That's one good aspect of a one hand reach. And then the second aspect is it keeps the ball still. Like my hand can't move all that much because that ball's got to stay in there. And so once you learn how to keep that ball still, then I get to dictate how I want to finish, as opposed to I'm moving the ball because it's a bad habit. And so now I'm a slave to that habit and I can only shoot this type of layup. If I can keep a ball still in a certain area, now I can develop the skills from my elbow to my fingertips to extend out toward the basket, up. I've just increased my range in different types of layups that I can actually finish when I've made that decision. So that seemed to be one of the faster ways to get guys to stop swinging the ball whether they use it or not doesn't really matter to me. They're all going to develop their own blueprint of go-to moves. We just give them some different options that they are possibilities to choose from. So I don't know if that, does that make sense to you?
Oh, I love that. Certainly I love the phrasing possibilities, because I think that's what our goal is, to not define it for them, but to give them possibilities that they, as you said, get a blueprint. But
let me ask you something else, because this is something from you that, again, how I've been evolving as a coach over the last probably 10 years more than anything else, is that you said decisions before skill. So again, when I'd say that, hey, coach, you're stretching me a little bit too far. Like, I'm not ready to hear that, but I want to hear it.
Yeah.
And I wrote it down again, and I've heard you say it again. And then I started thinking a little bit deeper, is mine would probably be skills develop while they're in the decision-making process. And that's been the major jump over the years, is where I'd start out. And again, a little bit of it's from my tennis background and how you develop a stroke. Too long on the 1-on-0. Too long on the coordination. And I know why. I know why I did it, because I wanted them to have immediate success when we put the defender out there. I wanted to skip the messy portion, and I wanted to skip the failure part. I wanted them to go from 1-on-0 to success. You know, I'm pretty sure that was my reasoning, and even though I had maybe didn't think it out that deep at that point in time. But what I found over the years is that we do way less 1-on-0 other than the initial teaching, or one rep on the right, one rep on the left. Here we go. Now we've got decisions to be made, or pressure to get your eyes off the rim or to get you off balance. And so it became, the only way to develop this skill is while we're in that decision-making process. Whatever scenario we set up, that is part of it. They're not two separate things. It's not skill and then live. They're all the same. In fact, I did get a chance to watch you on Coaching You, which was awesome. And I think some people may misconstrue what you're doing a little bit. At least I've had people try to explain what you're thinking. And the worst explanation is just constant games and you're just playing. You're just playing.
We're not.
And when I watch that, I watched some clips of your practices, and I watched some clips of you out there teaching. I mean, you may have more stoppages in live play than a guy that was doing a drill 1-on-0.
I think we do.
I saw a guy drive baseline, and I just cringed. But I know it's a clinic setting, and so you can't fix everything. I just cringed because he stopped, and then he did an inside pivot right where the defender was. He had the ball right on his belly. I was like, oh, geez. And then you stopped him right away. No, no, no. Where's the defender? You know, he was trying to make a decision on the weak side low guy, and if he's going to drift it or high skip it, whatever it was. But it's like, that's teaching. So that's teaching a skill at the same time that you're teaching a decision, which is what speeds up the process. And I think our goal is to maximize the time that we have them, because I don't care if you have them for 4 hours or 3 hours, you only have them for X amount of time. And I'm talking about their minds, because you'll lose them. We've had situations where we've had more coaches on the floor than we need. We have managers, we have everything. We have strength and conditioning, and we have 3 hours to work them. And we only had them for an hour and a half. We wasted their time. We sucked the energy out of them sometimes in that way. So maximizing time is everything in the learning process in our mind.
Coach, can you do all of my talks from now on? Because I don't think I could explain it
any better than that, to be honest. And sometimes to get a point across, you have to exaggerate it a little bit. And I think that's what's been shocking for some people, is when I say skill before the decision. But we know, like, this is proven fact, that it's perception, decision, skill execution in the process of executing the skill. So the reality is, it does actually happen before. The decision happens before the skill. But in your teaching process, there's no question. I'm not arguing against, as you said, doing repetitions of skill. What I'm saying is, as quickly as possible, get to interaction between the offense and the defense, because that's where they truly self-discover and that's where they truly learn. And I just think we're...
And that's where the most effective teaching that you can do happens.
No question, because it's like in the context.
Your words are so much more valuable in that context, as opposed to, hey, have an imagination here. You can't do that.
And I never want it to be criticism, coach, but from all levels I've dealt with, from NCAA to NBA down to youth levels, that is the constant question that you brought up all the time is, well, they're playing basketball in practice. Why are you stopping it so much? And I'm like, well, because again, like, why are you doing a drill? You're doing it to help them improve, right? That's why you're choosing a drill.
It's right.
Why coaches. So it's the same concept with a games approach, is that we're choosing what we're going to do to help them improve. And you know how you improve? You need feedback. You need feedback.
Yes. And I think, I'm pretty sure you did this. And we practiced like this. It was kind of, I kind of laughed, but you stopped a movement and then you started it from that same spot. So everybody was in the same spots. And I forget what term you used. You guys quickly knew what you were doing.
Yeah, recreate.
Recreate. And it was just beautiful because it didn't stop and start all over and you may never get to that situation again. The kid was right in that, he got some feedback. And I was right in that situation. Now I'm going to make the right play. I'm going to make the right decision.
Yeah, and it immediately gives them, as again, an understanding of what you're talking about. Because I think sometimes if you go three trips or five trips up and down the floor and then you give them summary feedback at the end of it, then they don't know you're talking about them, or they don't think you know you're talking about them, or they don't remember it. Like, we have far better recall than our players of what actually happened. And I think framing it in the moment is really impactful for a learner.
And again, because we like to pride ourselves in being a teaching program, and I'm not talking about the coaches, I'm talking about the players, is that for everybody to see that and to hear that, and it's kind of one of the reasons, and again, I'm constantly reevaluating things, but we really don't have a lot of individual meetings. And everything is, I don't want to say never, because there are some situations where that require one, but we want to be able to express ourselves in front of that team, and we want the team to be able to express themselves in front of their teammates. So when we're in film, it's an individual meeting in front of 15 other guys, and so at first it's a little bit uncomfortable if you're challenging somebody or, you know, pointing something out. But when they know what your intent is, the intent is to get them to feel, I really want every player to think this way. It's like, how good can I get? You know, they don't have to say it, but I want them thinking that because it kind of gives you goosebumps. I want to think that as a coach. But if they know that there's 14 or 15 other guys in there that are going to help you coach that particular point that we brought up, and then it doesn't become this hierarchy of I have all the answers and I'm the one that's going to tell you, so we're going to have an individual meeting and whisper it in your ear. No, I want 14 and 15 guys hearing that, so that, and we're creating coaches so that they can help you with that particular thing and vice versa. Then it's your responsibility to help them out. And so we become a culture of teaching as opposed to I gotcha. And so as long as they know that our intent is that, it's usually pretty good, and you can be as harsh as you want, or you express it any way you want, as long as your intent is correctly. It's not for me to be greatest coach on earth and have a bunch of wins. It's for us in this thing together to see how good we can become.
That's tremendous. And the terminology I use for our players and is that they're active participants in each other's learning, right? Well, and that's what you're phrasing for them, is that they're active participants in their learning. So we're all involved in each other's learning. And that includes when you're on defense in a drill, say it's a one-on-one or two-on-two drill, that you're engaged because you playing hard or you doing the things that we're trying to get you to do as a coach. Like, we say that all the time, oh, you got to play hard in defense. But when you kind of frame it as saying that you're actively involved in the offense's learning or vice versa, I think it helps them understand that we're all in this together to develop. And the other part that I love that you said is that your players and the terminology is that, like, I don't think there's anything that we've ever done that's helped our players more develop a culture than the words. The words. Like, it's not a team cohesion event off the court or anything like that. It's the words that they use. When they're all speaking the same words and they're all understanding the same words and they're teaching each other, that's when I know that we've got a great culture within our team.
Yeah, no question. And so, and again, I'm not anti-team development stuff. We just don't do it. There's just a limited amount of time, and I want to maximize what we have. And it's just kind of my theory, or what's comfortable for me, is that relationships will form out of this game. And it doesn't, not necessarily the other way. And I know some other guys are really good at that stuff, and they can develop all kinds of great relationships before we step out on the floor. But for me, like, the best relationships I've had have formed because of some tension on the floor, some tough times learning a skill, making the right decision. winning a game, losing a game. And then who knows where that conversation goes, but that's our team builder is practice. That's how we develop relationships. It's not, hey, at 12 o'clock, I need Johnny to come to my office so I can sit and talk to him. Well, no kid likes coming to a coach's office. Like I never did. I never wanted to. But I'm, you know, bumping into him, having some lunch with him. It's way different. And then, but again, it's just that fighting for something special on a basketball floor, a particular standard of play that you want. I mean, that's where you develop relationships when you're in a project with somebody else. Yeah, everything else seems to be a surface relationship unless you're in something with somebody else. And we've got that set up for the game of basketball. I mean, why do I need an outside expert coming in to teach my team how to juggle?
Right. And coach, I mean, it's what came through to me is there, it's like this is a partnership. It's not an ownership. And I do think far too many programs, when I see the schedules that players have and the demands that are placed on them as a student athlete, you know, at whatever level we're talking about, I'm just like, wow, when do they actually get to be a person? Because honestly, I know my players are far fresher, far more excited to be at practice when I don't have meetings during the day and we don't have all these scheduled demands. And I'm really conscious of the fact that essentially they're doing something to represent our university or our community or whatever it is. And I want to make sure that they get an opportunity to be a part of that community and not just be a basketball player.
No question. It even spills through to the basketball part. Having, you know, been able to coach junior college and Division II and Division I and now Division III, you know, the one thing I never wanted to coach was Division III because of the rules, because you can't really be with the players.
Yeah, I understand.
You start October 15th. But after going through this, and seeing how it's set up and how it can be set up, I think it's the greatest model of all time. And especially the Division I rules have changed, and I've got all kinds of friends in Division I, and you know, most their biggest complaint is that they can never really think about basketball. They've got too many other things going on. I always say that's your fault. The second thing would be is that when they are on the court and they're doing like individuals all year long, and it's happened to me a little bit at Tulane because it was set up this way, is that they become dependent upon you to develop their skills. And so you might be giving them good stuff, and I was giving them good stuff, I believe, but they became dependent upon me. And so as a coach, you do like that a little bit. You want to have value, but in the ultimate of goals, you're not really teaching them how to own their own game. And so after going through that a little bit and then coming here and not being able to do that, and then so in turn, what we did is we taught our guys how to coach. We taught our guys how to teach. And it's not easy. Like that's just as hard as teaching a guy how to play. And so it's really hard on the front end. But when we teach those things, so when we're done after a season and then they start doing their spring stuff, I mean, they're lining up four guys and they are conducting basically their own practices and they're taking ownership of their own game without coaches because we can't be out there having a thumb on them. Well, that's pretty liberating, you know, and then you get them back. And so now somebody has like a legitimate way they've been thinking about their game. They've been thinking about the game, not just their game. And they grow so much faster when you take your thumb off of them. And so Division I, you're afraid to do that. If you are afraid to step away and let them take control of their game. So those are just some thoughts.
No, I mean, that's fascinating. And I guess that's part of my exercise in my mind is that when I've got an opportunity to go watch NBA practices or if I've got an opportunity to watch Division I practices or professional practices, the exercise in my mind is, can it be done differently? And is there a better way? And I'm not saying there is. But that's always the thought process that goes in my mind when I go watch other levels or other situations, and even high school, to be honest. And I kind of sit there, and it's not in judgment. It's more in, if I'm ever in this position, what would I do? What would I do? Because there's a certain tradition or there's a certain norm or there's a certain this. And it's like, how much can you change it or how much could you do it differently? And
sure. I like to do it even during practice. We'll have a stage called Four Baskets where we can't coach. And whatever we've set up, you know, we're standing in the middle. We might yell out some things from the middle, but there's no coach at the basket. So there's a bunch of self-organization. It's, you know, eventually it actually looks pretty good. If you walked into our gym, it looks like we know what we're doing. But initially it's guys looking at each other, trying to figure out how to talk to each other, trying to push a guy down to a corner, it's just a bunch of stuff. But it's, you put them in a situation where it's going to happen eventually. And as opposed to like forcing talking, like you have to talk. Well, we like to talk and we're going to tell you to talk. But again, if you can put those guys in situations where they have no choice but to talk, I joke a little bit. We don't really do a warm-up. We call it a habits of movement type thing to start off practice, and it's geared just to make you feel good. You can't screw it up. And I want it that way. It can be 5 to 10 minutes long, but we are trying to create a habit with a certain type of picking up a right foot or picking up a left foot. It is a way for us to stretch and not waste time. But they come together, and I never say that you have to clap hands. You never have to touch hands. I saw some study where the best teams are clapping hands and doing high fives and that kind of stuff. And it's probably good. I don't make anybody do it. But I just noticed that a couple of the stuff that we do, it forced them to be right at each other. And then after about the third day, they just say, what the heck, I'm going to go ahead and hit that guy's hand. So, can we just like lead them into situations where it's almost impossible not to talk without me forcing it? There's forcing in coaching and do that as just like everybody else will too. But are there other ways to get that done that are more effective and last longer and are more meaningful?
Well, again, leadership is in a lot of ways getting them to do something and make it seem like their idea. And that's no question. Exactly what you're saying. And that's the art of this whole thing. And like the players talking thing is great for coaches to think about is like, again, the second drill I do at any camp is I teach a relatively complex 3-on-2 shooting drill with constraints, either shoot it or pass it. And I say that we're not going to coach it. I just say, get 3 out, get 2 on defense, figure out your rotations, figure out how you're getting on and off the floor. And I don't teach rotation. And I never teach rotation within my team because I think I'm taking away an opportunity for my team to figure things out and talk for each other. And at camp, it's exactly that. It's such an uncomfortable silence for like minutes. And I know coaches sure. who don't know me are there kind of going, what the heck's going on? Or parents are going, what's going on? This guy can't coach, because that's not their perception of coaching. But the reality is in the long run, it does more for those kids to figure out how to self-organize and figure out how to, communicate and all those different things. And that's what I say, how to get people to talk, put them in situations where they have to. And I love that you do those things for your players because they can figure out how
to. And I do think this is a big difference to just with age and experience and some deeper thought is that when you start this and you're not quite sure, you want that thing so organized so that you feel better about being a coach. And so you can become consumed with stuff that's not very important in order to save your self-esteem. At least that's how I kind of thought of it. If I wasn't quite sure about something, my mistake would be to organize it above and beyond reproach. And then the older I've got and the more experience that I have under my belt, I understand a little bit more about the time that it takes to acquire a skill and the failure that's necessary and the messiness that's necessary before we arrive there. So I can handle my self-esteem and my ego can handle messiness and not looking quite the way it should because it's supposed to be that way. And again, everything to me, we're not coaching disposable skills with basketball. Like these are life skills. I mean, that same statement I just said, that is life. Like you can't skip the messiness in life. You got to go through the failure. And if you think like something's wrong because you failed or something's wrong because it's not going the way it's said in your day planner, like you're going to have problems. But if you can expect that a little bit and you can anticipate it a little bit and deal with it, like that's where the true growth actually happens. If you can honestly, without making excuses, make assessments for that particular situation and move forward.
Tremendous. Again, I love that just the saying disposable skills. And as I said to coaches at the beginning, I just love so much of the language and the words you use, and they get right to the heart of it. And as you've already alluded to, in the teaching environment, we don't have time for wordiness, if that's even a word, but we don't have time for wordiness. We need to get right to the point.
Right.
People need to understand what we're talking about so that we can move on and keep playing the game. And it's interesting. Coach, I got to ask you this because I got asked this. I get asked this frequently. In competitive play and practice, like one of the arguments against a games approach is that my players have more of an opportunity to get injured in practice than if we're doing drills. And I'm going to let you answer it. And I think you can probably guess where I come from a little bit, but I'm just curious because you do a lot of small-sided games, you do a lot of interactive type of drills. Is that a concern, or is that, how would you answer that question?
It's about as much of a concern of mine as challenging your best player to do something better and having him quit. It's not a concern, because sometimes, yeah, he's our best player. We need to give him a little slack. We don't want him leaving, and especially at the Division I level, because he's got five guys in his ear. If he's not getting his playing time, if he's not getting the right attention, like, don't care. Like, 1 through 15, we're going to challenge you to be the best that you can. And so am I afraid that someone's going to quit? No, because they know my intent, and if they do, they do. Same thing with injuries, and it really came true when I came to Bethel, because one, a really good player – in a Division III, you can play multiple sports. It's still not easy, but it made me be a better coach, because I had to be more efficient and quicker with my teaching to get to the game with when someone misses 30 practices and you want him on the floor. But in the meantime, he's a really good running back, and every Saturday I'm out there watching him take that ball and play, and you know, he can get hit. I wish he was a backup quarterback with a red jersey on so he never got hit. And then after a while, you just watch it. He said, you know what? He could twist his ankle walking down the stairs. It's that we are overly concerned, overly paranoid with somebody getting hurt because of some live play. This is not a fun way to live. And usually you end up getting hurt on an air drill, or some coach has a pad and the kid turns his ankle and you thought you were doing a good job. And I mean, it is what it is supposed to be. I guess those are my thoughts.
Well, you can imagine I agree with that. And I've always said is that, well, like in a way we're preparing them to less likely get injured, because they're doing the movements and the different types of functions that they would actually do in a game. So we're not doing something different than the game. So they're actually more less likely to get injured because they're not doing anything out of the norm, so to speak.
Right.
So, but well, again,
I would agree with that.
Yeah, no. So again, I mean, it's all those things. It's just, again, what are we doing this for? We're doing this to develop our team the best we can. So the one thing I do is that we do practice less, like less duration. Our intensity stays high, but our duration drops for sure. And I think coaches all say that throughout the season, but I would say generally we practice less. So we would never have 3 hour or 2 hour practices after a certain point in the year, because
we're about an hour and a half, hour 45.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm having such a good time, I'd like to go longer, but we can't. We like to move those things on faster, but you know, we're accomplishing things at a high rate of speed. So, and again, that's changed over the years. And again, some of that is what we talked about earlier, is that how long do I have them? Not how much time do I have, how long do I have them? And it starts as soon as we put them in the film room. Like, that doesn't count. Yes, it does. That is, that's like a mental energy. It's whenever I stand in front of them is when we start, and I have to account for all of that time.
How about therapy? That's another part. Therapy is not this relaxing experience that some people kind of think. So you're absolutely right. Like, I love that. How long do I have them? It's not how much time. Yeah. It's how long do I actually have them present and able to be a learner and able to help our team improve or help themselves improve. So that's great. And again, so many things here, coach, that we can come back to. And I did want to circle back real quick because I didn't get a chance to get to it, but I had a great opportunity to watch Damian Lillard work out with Phil Beckner, who's a podcast guest here coming up. But, and you talked about the hard dribble and the pop on pickup. That was one thing that came through, that he did that every time he did anything off the dribble, was that hard dribble and pop. And I didn't get a chance, and certainly I didn't record it. But if there was one thing this summer I would have recorded for my player's benefit, it would have been that, to emphasize exactly what you said. That hard dribble and that ball pickup was just tremendous, watching a player of that level do it every time. Not once in a while, every time.
Yeah. No, that's a huge emphasis in our program. And if we're fighting for time and space because we think that's what allows us to make better decisions, I want to get that hand, I want to get that ball into wherever I'm protecting it as fast as I can. And the only way to do that is with the pound, and often with their offhand, because their hand more often than not goes to the side of a ball and they drop it. So if I'm a right-hander and I go left, a lot of times when they try to go left, they drop the ball. Their strong hand, they're usually a little bit better about pounding that ball. But we want to be able to pound it off both sides, not just because it's a cool thing to do. but because it's going to give me more time, which is going to allow me to see the right decision quicker, and it's going to slow the game down for me, if that makes sense.
Everything you do makes sense. Obviously, somewhat biased is in a good way because I've seen your stuff, and I've talked to so many coaches that just have so much tremendous respect for how you do it and what you do, and I love that. And I know this isn't our last conversation together, and I think after coaches listen to this, they'll want another one from us at some point, but I look forward to you going through a great season and us connecting again at some point in the future, and thanks again for being a guest.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime, and thanks for all that you do for the game.
Well, I appreciate that, and again, coaches, go to CoachDougNovak.com, and you can get his DVD there and so much more, and get a real feel for how a coach can present their program. And I've said this coach to a number of young coaches, so probably some of your stuff has been stolen everywhere, but when you go for an interview, if you want to know how to lay out your philosophy and everything like this, then Coach's philosophy page is a great example of that. And to be very concise and specific and not be wordy, I think you present a great example of that as well.
Thank you very much.
Awesome. To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.